Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program. Welcome to the Free Speech Zone.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Fred Thompson, it's getting tough for him out there. This from the Wire Services. Veteran career actor and Republican presidential candidate Fred Thompson expressed worries to reporters Tuesday that a successful White House bid could spell total career death. He said, it would be nice to get away from the FBI agent and district attorney roles. That's why I eventually decided to try out for the Oval Office part. But being forced to play presidents for the rest of your life, would that be much better? His resumes included Law & Order, Die Hard 2, U.S. Senator from 94 to 2003, and Baby's Day Out. He says, sure, you don't want to turn the work down. And it would be a solid 4 to 8 year gig, but after that, I'd always be known as that politician guy. Look at what happened to Reagan. He never worked again. Recent polls have placed Thompson among the GOP frontrunners, with many voters citing the value of his experience as U.S. president in the 2005 docudrama Last Best Chance. That, of course, from The Onion. Rich Galen, however, in a little more serious vein, the senior advisor to the Fred Thompson campaign, is with us. Hey, Rich, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Tom. I read that yesterday. I was in Washington. You can get The Onion in newsstands, and they're free. And I picked that up, and I was walking down the street and just howled. I love the Reagan never worked again.
Yeah, this is a career killer, becoming president if you're an actor.
Why would you do this?
Well, in a way, though, running for president has become a career builder for a lot of people. I mean, you know, Jesse Jackson, Dennis Kucinich. Not to say that these guys are you know, gratuitously doing it, but there have been a lot of people whose profiles have been dramatically elevated as a consequence. And obviously, they're not just the only two. As a consequence of running for president. What do you say to those folks who say, you know, Fred Thompson, you know, he's got an okay career, but gee, here's an opportunity for him to get a little more famous. He ain't all that serious about it.
Oh, no, I think quite the opposite. I mean, I don't know the details, of course, but giving up the Law & Order gig was a great gig. Giving up the ABC radio gig was a great gig. I mean, if anything, this is, I mean, not a career step back, but certainly income step backwards. You know, the guys you mentioned, and on the Republican side, people like Gary Bauer and, you know, people run for Tom.
Well, you can even argue Pat Buchanan.
Exactly right. I mean, they don't really have a chance. Well, Buchanan actually, you know, he got enough delegates to demand, as you may remember, a primetime speaking spot Houston convention that was the George H.W. Bush re-election convention.
Right, which many people think hurt George H.W. Bush.
I was just going to say, the late Molly Ivins, whom I disagreed with but just loved, wrote about the Buchanan speech, said it sounded better in the original German, which was one of the best political writing lines in the history of political.
Yeah, yeah.
But you're right.
Indeed.
So, people run. I don't think anybody puts themselves through this just for the fun of it, but I think you get people like Jackson or Buchanan or Tancredo, or I'm not sure about Mike Ravel, what he's doing. Kucinich certainly has an issue agenda, but it does give them the opportunity to have a spotlight shown on that particular issue, which otherwise somebody like Dennis Kucinich wouldn't get in 1,000 years. You know, as a minor congressman from the
country. and there are issues that he passionately cares about, and many of us do. Let's in fact, speaking of the issues, you're blogging over your website Mullings, MULLINGS.com, about Blackwater, and basically musing light, friendly, and happily about the existence of this company, saying that you were very pleased that they're there to protect you when you go to Iraq.
Right.
How far would Republicans go in privatizing government functions? I mean, why should we have a private contractor paying $150,000 a year to individuals and making a huge profit off our military operation in Iraq, rather than having soldiers there, as has always been done in the past?
Well, that's not what they're doing. You're making it sound as if they are mercenaries.
They are.
No. Well, if you're going to ask, you have to let me answer. What they do is they provide security to embassy personnel, which happens all over the world. All over, I mean, the Marines guard the embassy property. But when embassy staff or USAID people, in depending upon the level of danger, they always hire outside firms to do this, leaving the U.S. armed forces is free to do the jobs that they're trained to do, which is generally not personal security detail. That's not what the U.S. Army or the Marines do.
So you're suggesting
all over the world, private security firms are hired by the USG, the U.S. government, to provide personal security to high level officials.
We have right now more civilians, if the reporting that I've seen on the most recent numbers, we have more civilians in Iraq than we have soldiers.
Well, I think that's a good thing. You'd rather have. If we had three civilians, you think that would having more than soldiers would be better, right?
So that's well, no. What I don't understand is why, for example, we have Kellogg Brown and Root feeding our soldiers, and it turns out feeding them substandard food. When traditionally you had soldiers doing KP. I mean, it seems to me that an awful lot of this is just trying to avoid a draft, and in the process, some cronies of the Bush administration making a small fortune, maybe a large fortune.
Well, but you can look at your local police force. I don't know where you are, but you look at your local police force. It used to be that sworn officers did every job in the police station, from answering the phones to booking people to providing, you know, the typing skills. And over time, it became obvious that that's just a waste of trained personnel. And so now in every police force on the planet and every sheriff's office that I know of, they use civilians to do a lot of the non-military job. And if you're
But they're all employees of the police force, and they all have to subscribe to the rules of the police force.
If you're suggesting having a trained Marine stand there and serve food is a good use of trained Marines, I just disagree.
Well, it wasn't a combat Marine.
It's going to be some private entity, because it doesn't make any sense to use military personnel to cook. I mean, that's just silly.
Actually, it does make a lot of sense. Number one, it's low cost. Number two, it allows people who are in the field, in combat in particular, to cycle through jobs that are non-combat jobs and yet still remain in the field. So that they're available.
Why wouldn't you want to have the person trained? Why would you want to have a guy that's trained to maintain vehicles spending time literally cleaning pots and pans? That's just silly. That just doesn't make
sense. Well, to extend the logic then, why would you want to have a guy who's, why even bother to train a guy to maintain vehicles? In fact, I think that to a large extent, the Army is even outsourcing those kinds of things in Iraq to private contractors.
I couldn't agree more. I think that's right. I think other than actually gun-bearing things, we ought to look for reasons to outsource it to people that can do it and leave the trained people to do the trained things. Again, going back to the police department theory, that you'd rather have cops on the street than having those trained individuals sitting behind a typewriter kind of doing, clerical work. I think that makes great sense.
So, for example,
you're going in the wrong direction on this one, Tom. Let's go.
No, I'm really not.
Yeah, you really are. You are.
This is what Dwight Eisenhower warned us about, Rich.
Stop digging.
this is what Dwight Eisenhower warned us about, and he was quite explicit about this.
In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex. The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist. We must never let the weight of this combination endanger our liberties or democratic processes.
And I would submit that we're there. We had a woman on this program whose son was killed in Iraq, traveling back to the airport because for a week or two, KBR, had decided that it was too dangerous to transport the mail to the soldiers. And so they said to the soldiers, you want the mail, you got to go out to the airport yourself. And the soldiers were doing it. And whereas traditionally the Army had transported its own mail and they had figured out how to do it securely, and we've been doing this since the founding of this republic. And bringing in private contractors and running it at the profit motive and trying to do it in a way that is most efficient and most profitable for the corporation rather than what is best for the soldiers is, in my opinion, a disaster, a tragedy.
I don't know if that what you just said is true. B, I have been on that airport road, 300 times. No, that's not true. Probably 60 or 70 times. C, it's always dangerous to anybody traveling it. And D, there were times when the military and I was there when the CPA was there, that they thought it was too dangerous and they wouldn't even let food come through that thing. So there were times when when it was the airport road was shut down. If some, you know, some commander made a bad choice, then the commander made a bad choice. But I don't think you can draw a general conclusion from that. I think if you do, you're just incorrect.
So you think it's fine that we basically privatize our army in all regards except for shooting. Why not just privatize the shooting part, too?
Well, that's you started the conversation that way, and I told you you were wrong. That's how you started this whole conversation, thinking that Blackwater was a paramilitary organization that was supplanting the military, and I said that's wrong. So you've come all the way around to your own circular thinking.
So you're suggesting that we should not privatize the shooting?
Absolutely. I think we should have trained, sworn people that took the oath that I took, and if you were in the Army, you took, to protect, defend, and the Constitution and obey the orders of those above.
Rich Galen, Mullings.com, his website, senior advisor of the Fred Thompson campaign. Rich, thanks for talking with us today.
Thank you, buddy. Have a good day.
Thanks, you too. 16 minutes past the hour.
You're in the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman on Air America Radio.
So I think I'm understanding this now, and Rich is no longer with us, so I'm not going to try and put words in his mouth. But it seems that the at least the Thompson point of view is that if you're going to serve your country, really the only kind of service we want from you, thank you very much, is killing people. And if you want to join the military and you want to serve your country and you want to fix trucks, you want to service airplanes. You want to be a clerk. You want to be a chaplain. We can hire those things, and we can hire them, and corporations will make money on it. And isn't that a fine thing? And this is the whole corporatist worldview, this corporatist mindset that it's just, well, it's always better to let a corporation do it. It's always better to outsource it. And it just gives me the chills because it heads right back to Eisenhower's pointing out that at the beginning, in the beginning here in the United States, we did not have a permanent arms industry. It didn't exist. And, you know, he suggested that as a consequence of World War II, it came into being. And that in his opinion at that time, because of the perceived threat of the Soviet Union, its continued existence was necessary, but that it represented a significant danger. This, and again, Eisenhower talking about this.
Our military organization today bears little relation to that known of any of my predecessors in peacetime, or indeed by the fighting men of World War II or Korea. Until the latest of our world conflicts, the United States had no armaments industry. American makers of plowshares could, with time and as required, make swords as well.
And that's what happened. That's what happened. Franklin Roosevelt mobilized the automobile industry to make tanks and so on. But the military, it's this whole broad thing of being together in this thing. You know, soldiers, that we're all in it together. And the guy who's doing KP and the guy who's out there, walking point, they're part of the same group. And in fact, they may be taking turns in doing these things. And there's a variety of skills being it just seems to me a really dangerous road to go down. Shannon in Brainerd, Minnesota, rather. Hey, Shannon, welcome to the program. Thanks for calling.
Hey, Tom. Good to be back on the show. I just got out of the Army like 4 years ago, and I was in the Signal Corps, and they're starting to outsource a lot of the Signal Corps stuff, a lot of the Quartermaster's Corps stuff. I think it's a really bad idea, basically, because you're going to spend more on a guy who you're going to have to pay to go into a combat zone. You're going to have to pay him an exorbitant amount of money. Then you got to make sure the corporation that hires that guy has got to make sure that their profit is covered on that. And right. If we have anything close to like a Tet Offensive, we are going to be wading in civilian blood, American civilian blood.
Right.
Because if for some reason the enemy gets organized and overruns one of our posts.
Or if, for example, we decide to start dropping bombs on Iran and that causes the Shia and the Sunni in Iraq to join forces and rise up against us and just say, okay, that's it. It's now the war of civilizations. It's the Christians of the West against the Muslims the Muslims of the of the Middle East and we're going to take you guys out. You're right. You're absolutely right.
It wasn't the infantry that held back the Pusan perimeter. It was the quartermaster's corps. It wasn't the infantry
tell me what is the quartermaster's corps? Pardon my military ignorance here.
It's supply.
I'm sorry?
It's supply and logistics.
Oh, okay. So the guys who deliver the mail, the guys who bring in the food, the guys who bring in the supplies.
Right. The quartermaster's corps, the signal corps, the ordnance corps, those are all supplies, support and logistics corps of the army. The infantry corps is the war fighters.
Right.
And it's not when the poop hits the fan, as it were, it's not the infantry that alone that holds back the tide of the enemy. They've got a whole bunch more soldiers in the support position who have rifles, who are trained to fight, and there just in case. And that's
right.
What you need to run an army.
Yeah, this is where, particularly in Iraq, which is because of the incompetence of 4 years of a bungled occupation, in large part because of all the economic changes made by L. Paul Bremer, from firing the army to, doing away with the making unions illegal, doing away with all the anyhow, you've got 50, 60, 70% unemployment. The whole country is a combat zone, and it just seems nuts.
It's a powder keg waiting to explode. And there's a recent example of this: the Black Hawk Down incident. It was the supply and logistics people who were holding off the enemies at the gates of the base in the 10th Mountain Division. I know guys. I was in the army with guys who were in that conflict, and they were supply guys. And they were firing on the enemy because they were about to be overrun.
Interesting. Shannon, thanks for the insight and the perspective.
Yeah.
I appreciate it. Thanks for the call. Good to hear from you. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. TomHartmann.com, AirAmerica.com, our websites. If you want to drop into our live chat room or participate in the blog over at AirAmerica.com, our message board over at TomHartmann.com, you'll find it all. Pretty much regardless how you spell Tom Hartmann, you should be able to find it. 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartmann Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at
866-303-2270. Young man sitting on the witness stand. The man with the book says, raise your hand. Repeat after me, I solemnly swear. The man looked down at his long hair. And although the young man solemnly swore, nobody seemed to hear anymore. And it didn't really matter if the truth was there. It was the cut of his clothes and the length of his hair. And the lonely voice of youth cries, what is truth? Young girl dancing to the latest beat has found new ways to move her feet. A young man speaking in the city square is trying to tell somebody that he cares. Yeah, the ones that you're calling wild are gonna be the leaders in a little while. This old world's waking to a newborn day, and I solemnly swear that it'll be their way. You better help that voice of youth find what is truth.
And we better. And we are right here. Tom Hartmann with you, 35 minutes past the hour. Welcome back to our program. Oh, 1-866-303-2270. Richard in Seattle. Hey, Richard, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. Thank you. I just get really irked. You are an expert at linguistics and using words in powerful situations. And obviously, many people on the right do not want to use the term mercenary. It's a loaded word. And yet it applies absolutely. If I have a rent-a-cop, pardon the slur, if you will, at a local grocery store or department store, they're not authorized to shoot me. They have not taken an oath to protect and serve. they have to call a policeman to help them if they have to arrest somebody or if, God forbid, they have to shoot somebody. These people, Blackwater, who shot these innocent people who just happen to be standing by, they are, for all intents and purposes, mercenaries. No other word really applies.
Well, or maybe something quite different from mercenaries that we don't yet have a category for. Because mercenaries, technically, I mean, you know, we had, when we fought the Revolutionary War, there were Hessian soldiers, German soldiers who came over, and they were rent-a-soldiers. And, you know, having people who are supposed to be providing security detail instead, I mean, you see some of these YouTube videos, and I'm not sure that we can track any of them back to any particular company.
Are you referring to the Elvis soundtrack music?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, there's one of them in the movie No End in Sight. They are obviously private contractors. We don't know which company, where they're just running around shooting people, shooting Iraqis for fun. And, you know, that goes way beyond mercenary. Now, obviously, that's not something that anybody is sanctioning or saying, gee, this is what it should be. But my point is, that's what you end up with when you don't have people who have to conform to the Uniform Code of Military Justice, who are in the, you know, who are in the Army and subject to its discipline, or who are, you know, the local police departments, as it were, or have very, very clear and specific, you know, functions. And
isn't that the problem? Blackwater, for instance, that they're not accountable to the United States government. They're not accountable to the Iraqi government. If a security guard shoots me, they are accountable. If a policeman shoots me, he has to fill out lots of forms and probably has to go to court to solve the problem. Blackwater
Bremer,
is accountable to no one.
That's right. Bremer passed this rule that said that the private contractors there that were providing security for whatever, you know, for fill in the blank, we're not subject to the Uniform Code of Military Justice. We're not subject to U.S. law, and we're not subject to Iraqi law. If you're operating outside the law, that's something beyond a mercenary, because even mercenaries operate within the law. We're in uncharted territory. It's corporatism run amok, and I think it's a dangerous thing. Richard, thank you very much for the call. Bob in Eureka, California. Hey, Bob.
Hi, Tom. Oh, man, I was just thinking that if I was going to have an audio dictionary and I wanted to illustrate the definition of disingenuous, I would just play that interview. I was in the Navy during Vietnam, and we cooked our own food, and I was a water maker. Now, okay, I know how to use a rifle, but I made water for an aircraft carrier. Now, should we have privatized that?
Well, I can't speak for Richie's not here, but I think that his logic would certainly suggest that. Yeah.
And
that seems to me like a dangerous thing to do, and that's the direction that we're moving, rather rapidly, I would add. And basically turning all functions of government over to corporations. In fact, the bigger picture, and I even thought about keeping Rich on for another segment. Maybe we'll talk about it, you know, in a future time. Is where do you draw the line? At what point? I mean, shall we privatize the post offices? There's some of them that are being privatized. And frankly, I'd rather not have the pizza delivery guy, a guy who was a pizza delivery guy last week and this week is working for the private corporation that's maybe even owned by the same pizza company, delivering my bills and checks and confidential information. You know, but we're privatizing post offices. It's happened right here in Portland, Oregon. We're privatizing schools. I mean, this is one of the big accomplishments of the Bush administration down in New Orleans. They're all bragging about it, how they've gotten pretty much rid of the public schools, and it's been all replaced by charter schools to a large extent. And they're not working out all that well. There's been some good reporting on that. And this, again, what we're seeing is corporatism run amok. And it's as I said, I think that it is an ideology that is fundamentally antithetical to democracy when you get right down to it. Bob, I got to move along. I appreciate the call. Dimitri in Salem, Oregon. Hey, Dimitri.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. I'd just like to tell you, I was a captain in the Army in Iraq during 2004. Your guest mentioned that we should, he thought we should privatize things like vehicle maintenance even in the military service. And my concern with that is that the end goal of a corporation is to make profit. And so if they're fixing my vehicles, they know that they're going to not make money if the vehicles are in perfect running order all the time. And so their real goal isn't to actually fix the vehicles, it's to keep making money, to keep having those vehicles come into the shop.
Right, and you also get the thing of, you know, are they going to use the cheap Chinese replacement parts or the original GM parts kind of thing?
Exactly.
And if it's a local shop that's doing auto repair, you know, to a certain extent, the kind of libertarian Republican, well, you know, the public will figure out that they're doing a lousy job and they'll go out of business. That makes sense. But if you know, and you can argue that. I mean, you can also argue against it. In a big city, you know, there's always going to be an unending supply of suckers. But nonetheless, there is some sense to that argument. The so-called free market argument. But in a combat zone where you know, the soldiers have no choice over, you know, they're not going to pick, well, let's see, we've got four different companies here that are willing to service our vehicles. We had a tire just blown up by an IED. We got to, you know, do something right now, or a front wheel blown off. I mean, you know, am I making sense?
Yeah, well, for example, I was in the field artillery, and we had a private contractor, a private company that designed and built our fire direction software. And the software would consistently ship to us with bugs. And every year, we had to buy a new version of that software in order to keep our guns and our fire direction computers talking to each other. And there was definitely the sentiment with a lot of the guys that had been around there forever that they were intentionally shipping it to us with bugs so that next year we'd have to buy the next generation of their software. So my point is that a company wants to make money. The Army wants to end the war. They want to finish the job. They want to do their job and get out of there. But a company, their best interests are to keep things going.
Keep the thing going as long as possible.
Keep the same state. And yeah, so if we privatize things like vehicle maintenance and paperwork, things like that, the goal isn't to get the best service. The goal is to keep making that company money.
Right. And the vast majority of Blackwater's contracts, just, again, not to personalize it to this company, except that Rich is singing their praises over on his blog, the vast majority of them are no-bid contracts. And so, I mean, even the much-vaulted element of competition is not coming into this. Dimitri, thanks for your comments. Tomas in Grand Rapids, Michigan, listening to WTKG. Hey, Tomas, what's up?
President Hartman, how are you today?
Yeah. No, not a chance of that, Tomas. I'm great, but I'll get better. How about you?
All right. Well, listen, I think the president should have just said, you know, from now on, Blackwater is going to be in the military chain of command, so, and they will be having to obey the UCMJ. That's all. It wouldn't have cost 1 cent. And right there, you know, anytime there was an incident, they would have to go through the military system, and they could be thrown in the brig and things like that.
Okay, so if you're in the UCMJ, there's a particular hierarchy that has to do with how things are conducted, from who you have to salute and how you address people to how you have to behave and how things are done. It is a Blackwater guy an E3 or an E6 or an E1? I mean, I don't think that makes any sense to us. I understand where you're going, but, you know, that they should be accountable to somebody.
Have a situation ongoing in Iraq right now, where you have a lot of contractors and active duty military confronting each other all the time, you know, one will accuse the other of something or the other.
Right. And I know that a lot of the military guys, I hear from military guys that they're resentful of the fact that there are other people over there who are doing the jobs that they used to do, who are being paid $150,000 a year to do it, and they just don't like it. Tomas, got to move along. I appreciate a lot of calls here. John in Glendora, California. Hey, John.
Good morning, Tom. In rebuttal to your first interview on the first part of the hour, when they want to privatize everything, I was in the military, and the reason I went in is to get some experience. So when I decided to get out, it would help me find a job or at least give me an idea of what I'm getting myself into. And also when he said, you know, yeah, these private contractors, Blackwater, are hired to protect these diplomats. Well, those were jobs that Special Forces did when they would retire from the military. That was a choice they had, was to either go work for a private firm or corporation that had their own security, like the guy that ran against, that sent his own security people into Iran to rescue the people that were being held hostage.
Yeah,
and now these jobs are being taken away, so you can't get more experience. I mean, what can you do when you shoot people? What kind of jobs can you get civilians?
Yeah, and that's exactly. And that's who wants to join the Army just to learn how to kill people? I mean, it's got to be something broader than that. Interesting point, John. Thank you very much for the call and for making it. 45 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. We'll be back with your calls, 866-303-2270, right after this.
Truth in Blood. Broadcasting. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
And welcome back. 9.5 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. And strange stuff going on out there. Germs sent to outer space come back meaner. Yep. CNN reports it sounds like a plot for a scary B movie, but it really happened. Salmonella, best known as a culprit in food poisoning. They took two identical batches of it, put them in petri dishes, sent one into outer space, kept the other one in a largely identical environment in terms of temperature and whatnot. And then gave both of them to mice. And the ones fed with the space germs are three times more likely to get sick. Strange stuff. Very strange stuff. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. And David in Queens, New York, listening on WWRL. Hey, David, what's on your mind?
Hey, how you doing, Tom?
Good. What's up?
Here's, unfortunately, you and your callers have been discussing the good part of that scenario. Let me give you the bad part. What if that contractor decides he can make $5 billion over a five-year period working for us, and then the enemy offers to give him $10 billion to sabotage us? Where do you think he's going to, his loyalties are going to lie? He's going to sabotage us.
Well, and in fact, we may have already seen that. We have $8 billion that is missing in Iraq. I mean, physical dollars that are missing in Iraq right now. And, yep. And we also have reports right now that some of these contractors have been smuggling weapons on the side into the Iraqi insurgents because it's more profitable.
Yep. So I think people should wake up and see the bigger picture. It's not bright.
Yeah. Well said, David. Thank you very much. JR in Vancouver, Washington. Hey, JR.
Morning. I think that last gentleman and, the previous caller that was talking about military or contracts to fix vehicles, I think that kind of plays into this Blackwater scenario. He's absolutely right. Corporations are there to make money. And who's to say that these individuals aren't taking part in, destabilizing the situation in the holster?
Yeah. JR, you're breaking up. But the point is what we're seeing here is the gradual, and I'd say it started in 1981, when Reagan was inaugurated.
I've always felt the nine most terrifying words in the English language are, I'm from the government and I'm here to help.
We're seeing the gradual erosion and destruction of the concept of the commons, of the concept of we're all in it together. Malloy in New York City, if I'm pronouncing that right. Or Maloli. Hello? In New York? Listening on WWRL? Nope. Okay, let's see. Phil in Onegin, Washington. Hey, Phil.
Okanagan.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Appreciate if you could let me make 2 points, Tom. It's been 30 years since I've been in the service. I joined the Navy, became a corpsman, and had what some people would consider the misfortune of being attached to the Marines because the Marines don't have their own medical, or at least didn't back then. What I learned with the Marines was that it didn't matter if you were a cook, didn't matter if you were a corpsman, didn't matter if you fixed vehicles. When there was a fight, everybody put down the wrench, put down the ladle, put down whatever you're doing as a medic. You picked up your weapon and you fought. That's point one. Point two was people have discussed several horrific scenarios. I'd like to throw another one in. Let's imagine that you're in one of these bases. And you're overrun, and you've got cooks that are private individuals who haven't been trained to handle a weapon. You've got mechanics. You've got secretaries. You've got all of these civilians who have never handled a weapon. Now, instead of having all of those individuals as assets, as a means to repel whoever's attempting to take over your base, they're all liabilities. They all have to be protected. What is wrong with that maniac you interviewed? He couldn't have possibly ever been in a combat situation in the military to say something as insane as what he was saying. And why isn't the military going nuts about this?
Well, one of the things that we're hearing from the military is that they are going nuts about it, and that there's a lot of military people who are very upset about the, this whole spectrum of stuff that's going on, the breaking of the military. Many of the generals and higher ranking officers who in some cases retiring and hurting their pensions and whatnot just to bail out because of how badly things are being done are speaking out about these kind of issues. But Phil, your points are brilliant and very well made, and I appreciate it. Thank you very much for calling and sharing them with us. Ed in Detroit, Michigan. Hey, Ed, listening on WDTW.
Hi, Tom. Hey, the other night on the radio, I heard a statistic that said that 40% of American taxpayer money goes to the funding of U.S. corporations and businesses and private contractors that are overseas, and 60% goes to the military. What if the United States Congress said, we are going to fully fund the American troops, but from this day forward, not one more cent goes to private contractors or American corporations in that.
Well, then you're back to the situation that you had in World War II and in Vietnam and the Korean War and whatnot, where most of these jobs, as the guy who called before, you know, the guy who's the cook and the guy who's the mechanic, are part of the military. And that would require a draft if Bush wants to have all his wars. And they're afraid to go there. I see this as a way of accomplishing two things. One, increasing the corporatization of America, you know, doing away with government functions. And number two, avoiding a draft.
Absolutely. But what do you think about the idea of could Congress specifically cut off funding for the U.S. corporations but keep funding the United States military over there? In other words, dry them out. Don't give them any more money.
Yeah, it's entirely possible. It's entirely possible. Ed, thanks for the call and for the note. Peter in Staten Island, got about a half a minute before we got to wrap this hour up. Peter, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. I wanted to say that I think that this privatization aspect is all part of a program that you allude to in your book, and it's a way for shrinking the government so that all parts of the government can function. They're after entitlements. They're after the Constitution. It's all part of a plan that has attacked the voting system. It has attacked every aspect of the government that they really despised ever since Roosevelt. And
that's
in the forefront of their agenda. Everything that they do is aimed at unraveling what was created before Reagan, and it's not stopped. And we're only beginning to find out about some of the things that they've done. We can only guess.
Yeah. No, you're absolutely right, Peter. You're absolutely right. As Limbaugh says,
Roosevelt is dead. His policies may live on, but we're in the process of doing something about that as well.
Replace government of, by, and for the people with governance of, by, and for the corporations and inherited wealth.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio. Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Talk radio for the rest of us.
Welcome back. Is the U.S., for that matter, the world, but specifically is the United States on a path to economic Armageddon, or for that matter, perhaps, you know, a warfare-based Armageddon, but particularly the economic dimension of this? Wanted to check in with Paul Craig Roberts on this topic. He's an economist, nationally syndicated columnist for Creators Syndicate. He was the Assistant Secretary of the Treasury during the Reagan administration, earning him fame as the father of Reaganomics. He's a former editor and columnist for the Wall Street Journal, for Business Week, for Scripps Howard News Service, and was former contributing editor for the National Review, whose current editor, Rich Lowry, I debated on Fox News yesterday. His website, most of his writings are published either at counterpunch.com or vdare.com. Paul Craig Roberts, welcome to the program.
Hello, Tom. Thanks.
Great to have you back with us. You have written recently about Alan Greenspan's memoir, or kind of using that as the plot device for your column about America's hegemonic status slipping away. Is this the end of the American empire? Is that a good thing? What's your take on where we're at right now with regard to not just empire, but the dollar? I mean, this it's all interrelated, it seems.
Yes, Tom, the American empire depends on the dollar's role as reserve currency.
Right.
The only reason the United States is a so-called superpower is that the U.S. dollar is acceptable anywhere in the world to settle any bill, so that any and every country can pay any bill in dollars. And that's the only reason there's been a demand for the enormous supply that U.S. budget and trade deficits produce every year. So,
in other words, the only reason that we are able to borrow money from the rest of the world is because the rest of the world is willing to take our dollars to loan us money and take our dollar and use our dollars and circulate our dollars because it's the reserve currency of the world, largely because of oil, is it not?
No. Oil is actually a very small component of the United States balance of trade deficit.
No, I understand that, but the dollar being the reserve currency for the world, is that not largely because most oil is traded in dollars? I mean, there's all this concern about what happened.
No, Tom, anything can be paid. Manufacturing bills, food bills,
right?
Military purchase. The reserve currency role the dollar's had since World War II, it used to be a role held by gold. And then by the British pound. And the two world wars, the debts associated with them destroyed the British pound's role to be reserve currency. And the dollar inherited it. And until the early 1970s, when Nixon closed the gold window, foreign central banks could hold dollars or they could cash them in to Fort Knox for gold.
Right.
So the dollar has, so this is a role which simply means that how do foreign central banks keep their reserves so they can carry on their monetary policy and pay their trade bills, and it's because the dollar is used. So that is our power. In other words, if the dollar was not the reserve currency right now, we probably couldn't be at war. Because the federal government is broke, several hundred billion in debt. American consumers are broke, couldn't stand a tax increase or any benefit cuts. And if we couldn't borrow, we wouldn't be able to fight this war.
Right. And we're approaching, many would suggest, the point where we may not be able to borrow.
We may be approaching that at the end of last year. The dollar's role as reserve currency had declined, and now foreign central banks hold 66% of their reserves in dollars, 25% in euros, and 9% in other currencies. So this is a big change. It'll be interesting to see what it is at the end of this year. What is happening to the dollar is that the endless excess supply of dollars has greatly eroded their value. The dollar has fallen some 30% in recent times. And foreign central banks are holding a rapidly depreciating asset. It's like buying a new car and you drive it off the showroom floor and it loses value dramatically. Well, that's what's been happening to the dollar. So,
right.
What we are faced with now, I think, is that the Greenspan Fed and the current Fed, two irresponsible operations, produced such low interest rates that they created a bubble in housing prices and all the associated mortgage scandals and subprime derivatives associated with it that now threaten the viability of numerous financial institutions. And it looks like the Federal Reserve is responding to this crisis by producing yet more liquidity, you know, creating
right.
more dollars.
This is what Bernanke did when he just dropped the prime by 50 basis points.
Yes.
And he's my theory is that what these guys are trying to do is they're trying to play out the clock until the next election. that they're trying to hold, they're holding this economy together with spit and baling wire, glue and rubber bands until November of 2008. And then, particularly if a Democrat is elected president and the Democrats can retain control of the House and Senate, then, it's going to come boing, it's going to come unsprung, and 1929, here we are.
Well, the consequence of the liquidity that they're dumping out to try to bail out the threatened financial institutions
is going to be inflation.
It further erodes the dollar's role as reserve status. And so what the fool at the Fed is doing is finishing off the dollar. And
right.
What you have to understand, what Americans need to understand is once the dollar is no longer accepted as reserve currency, we cannot pay for our imports. We're far more dependent on imported manufactured goods than we are on foreign oil.
Right, because we've by and large shut down all our manufacturing and shipped it offshore.
So much of it comes in, it's from offshore production of American firms.
Yeah.
And so we reached the point where, like last year, we consumed $836 billion more of the world's goods and services than we produced. And that's because the world was willing to take $836 billion in dollar assets. Well, once the dollar is not the reserve currency, they don't want it. It's just a banana republic currency. I mean, Botswana can't pay their bills in Botswana, whatever it is, and neither can Argentina. So by dumping all this liquidity, we're getting into a situation where two things. One, we can't pay for the imports. Plus, when the dollar loses the reserve currency role, it'll lose what's left of its value. So when the American consumer goes into Walmart to buy all the cheap foreign goods, he'll think he's in Neiman Marcus.
Right. In terms of sticker shock.
I would submit
to you, sir, that this really began with the administration that you served in, the Reagan administration, and in part is an outgrowth of Reaganomics, the idea of absolute laissez-faire, free markets in quote, supply-side economics as opposed to traditional demand-side economics. Do you disagree?
Well, of course I disagree. That's nonsensical, Tom.
Why?
Well, the Reagan, first of all, when I was Assistant Secretary of the Treasury in the early 80s, we didn't have any trade deficits. And to the extent we had any temporarily, it was entirely oil. We were a credit to nation, not a debtor nation.
No, I understand that. But was not Reagan arguing, certainly George Bush following him did, for the ability to do away with tariffs that protected our domestic industries and basically kicking open the doors to multinational corporate trade? I mean, we have a situation now where more than 40% of all international trade is within individual companies. Can you stick around? And if you don't mind, can you stick around over the break and we'll finish the conversation?
Okay, Tom. Will do.
Great. Thank you very much. We're talking with Paul Craig Roberts, counterpunch.com and vdare.com, websites where you can find his writings. Former Assistant Secretary of the Treasury in the Reagan administration. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People on Air America Radio.
Minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. We're talking with Paul Craig Roberts. Mr. Roberts, first of all, I want to say you and I have talked about a variety of topics over the years, and I salute and honor your position against the war in Iraq. You're coming out and stating that you believe that George W. Bush should be impeached, frankly. A variety of things we agree on. I'm curious, though, where you think it seems to me that this whole thing, that what we're seeing here, the destruction of the American middle class, outsourcing of jobs, moving things offshore, the destruction of the dollar, ultimately all tracks back to the essentially the end of demand side economics, which was the end of the New Deal, which was in 81 when Reagan was sworn in, and the beginning of supply side economics and neoliberalism. You know, this adoption of a really rather radical and different economic model. And I don't frankly know what your role was in that or what you think of that. But if that wasn't it, in your opinion, what was? I mean, how did we get into this mess?
Okay, Tom, I'd be glad to answer that. I don't have any idea why you think that or see these connections. What Reaganomics was about was curing stagflation. What you call demand-side economics, change in demand management. The way it worked in the post-war period was it used easy monetary policy to fuel demand, hoping to maintain full employment.
Well, in large part, it used government spending to fuel demand. It was the government being the employer of last resort.
Tom, don't. I'm the economist. All the Keynesians, at least the later ones, understood completely that deficits didn't do any good if the Federal Reserve didn't accommodate them with monetary expansion, because demand doesn't expand if the government borrows money from you, from the private sector, to pay for its deficit. It just transfers private spending to public spending. There's no net increase in spending. So any net increase in spending has to come from monetary expansion, from monetary accommodation. So to get back...
Wouldn't that just be called inflation?
It resulted in inflation, yes. And that is why you had stagflation. You had easy money. See, they would use easy money to put pressure of demand on employment. And then to restrain the inflation, the Keynesians used high tax rates. So the notion was, the policy didn't make any sense on its face, because you're putting money in with the Fed and taking it back out with taxes. So that was the idea. But what was really happening was the pressure of monetary ease on demand, instead of causing employment and real output to increase, over time would cause prices to rise more and more and more. So initially, you had 2% inflation, then 3%, then 4%, and all the Keynesians would say, "Well, we have to have some amount of inflation in order to have full employment." And the thing kept on getting higher and higher and higher. So in Jimmy Carter's time, you had high unemployment and high inflation.
Right. You don't think that was the result of the guns and butter policy of LBJ and
Nixon? No, of course not. It was the result of monetary pressure on demand and high tax rates, which curtailed output. You had 70% taxes on investment income.
Right, but those tax rates had been reduced by John Kennedy in 62 or 63.
Hey,
it was 90% before that, and you didn't have the inflation.
Tom, do you want me to explain it, or you want to repeat stuff that hasn't anything to do with it? Of course, they'd come down from 90% to 70, but how many people are going to go to the trouble of making new investments when you get to keep 30%? Especially when inflation is rising. Every time inflation rises, it erodes the real value of all the depreciation allowances. So nobody was recovering their depreciation either. So the effective tax rates on investment were far higher than 70%. So you had a situation where stagflation resulted from flooding demand with money and then restricting output with high tax rates. So what was supply-side economics? It simply reversed the policy. He said, no, we won't do that. We'll have lower tax rates to encourage output, and we'll have tighter money to restrain inflation. And it worked. You haven't seen stagflation since Reagan. You haven't seen any Phillips curve trade-offs between employment and inflation since
But we
Reagan.
Also haven't seen the growth of the middle class like we saw in the 40 years that preceded Reagan.
Haven't seen the growth of what?
The middle class. But what we've seen is that real income in the United States has declined since Reagan came into office.
Tom, you're talking about the times beginning after Reagan, when world socialism collapsed and first world corporations had at their disposal the excess labor supplies in former socialist countries like China and India, where they could then offshore their production.
So in the David Ricardo sense, you're saying that it was the increase in labor supply that drove down wages.
None of this could happen until the collapse of world socialism, which freed those labor supplies, and the rise of the high-speed Internet. None of those were present under Reagan.
Interesting. Well, I'm sorry we're out of time. It's the bottom of the hour. And I very much appreciate your being with us, and always interesting to talk with you. Paul Craig Roberts, Counterpunch.com, VDare.com. Thank you, sir, for being with us.
Sure. Call me back sometime.
Will do. 27 minutes past the hour.
Is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at
6:36, Closer to democracy here. Sometimes you take a few turns, going left and right and all around, but we're moving ahead. And there's also some strange stuff going on out there. Hey, you want donuts when you're a senior? Seniors in New York nursing homes are trying to remedy injustice. All started out in Putnam County, New York, a senior center. Stopped giving away free donuts. Well, actually stopped accepting donations of free donuts, pies, and breads. This really upset a 75-year-old former labor organizer, Brave Joe Hedgekowski. Good on you, Joe. He organized the folks in the seniors' home, and he said, that's it. You know, this is lack of respect. He says, that's what this is all about. And so the seniors got together, and as Rita Jorgensen, 80-year-old Rita Jorgensen, she says, it was disgusting the way people went after them. I think the senior center did them a favor by taking it away. And they got their donuts back. So one day in the union halls, they're going to sing songs about Brave Joe Hedgekowski.
I dreamed I saw Joe Hill last night.
No, it's Joe Hedgekowski. And he stood up for what he wanted. Delicious jelly donuts.
Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, said he.
No, Joe's just 75 years old. By the way, if I end up in a nursing home, I'd like Brave Joe there with me. And I'd like all my jelly donuts from the Mad Woman Bakery in Minneapolis. Man, they've got the best lemon poppy seed gluten-free tea cakes ever, I got to tell you. It's, anyhow, what... How did I get off on that? 1-866-303-2270. David in Los Angeles, California. Hey, David, what's on your mind today?
Well, I didn't appreciate that so-called economist. He had an shrine.
Paul Craig Roberts.
That made him less of a scientist.
Well, it's interesting. Every conversation that I've had with him in the past has been in the context of our agreed criticisms of the Bush administration, from the war to his call for the impeachment of George Bush. And I thought, since he, you know, bills himself as the father of Reaganomics, it'd be interesting to have a conversation about Reaganomics.
Well,
I'll acknowledge that he's the economist and I'm not, but I do know, I think, a fair amount about economics and supply side economics, flipping this upside down and having monetary policy. I mean, this is Milton Friedman came up with this idea in the Chicago school back in the late 30s, early 40s.
And
say what?
And that guy Laffer also.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Laffer with his curve. Yeah, that was more the justification, you know, for the tax cuts. But you know, the fact of the matter is that we did not see stagflation during the time when we had a 91% top marginal rate.
The fact of the matter is that they raised interest rates so bad that we saw deflation and we saw mass unemployment. We made the term homeless acceptable.
Yeah, under the Reagan administration.
And, of course, that led to the collapse of the family farm, and the corporate farms got to swallow them up. And then there was the fabulous borrowing party, which put us into the historically huge deficit. Well, anybody can do that.
Yeah, the Reagan administration borrowed more money than every president before it combined. Good point, David. Thank you very much. And you know, I guess this is where, you know, people differ in their opinions. Mike in Michigan. Hey, Mike.
Hey, great show. I do like jelly donuts, by the way. But
yeah, me too.
Anyway, I'm
especially if they're gluten-free.
And I've lived through a lot of this, and you're right. The supply side economics, the trickle down, and now with our currency is the same as the loonie in Canada.
Right. The Canadian dollar is at parity with the U.S. dollar.
The loonie now. Okay. But what happened, you know, with Nixon and the gold standard? Now our money, you know, our money is worth paper.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that was a huge mistake, Nixon taking us off the gold standard. And I frankly, you know, never understood what the rationale was. I mean, Nixon suggested and his economists suggested that if the economy was going to continue to grow, you had to have, you know, enough dollars to reflect the increase in population and goods and services. And that as a result of the gold rush of the 1840s and the subsequent finding of gold in various places in the United States, we were able to acquire enough gold in Fort Knox to back up our dollars and all was well. But as if the economy was going to grow beyond that, that we couldn't do it if we had to reference everything to gold. And I'd say nonsense. You just, what it would do is make the dollar stronger. I think that what was really going on was that they wanted to have a slightly weaker dollar, in order to be able to pay for the war in Vietnam. One of the things that government does, unfortunately, and particularly in collusion with fractional reserve banking and Federal Reserve systems like this, is it borrows money, and then it pays it back later at, you know, with dollars that are worth less. And it's a whole heck of a lot easier to inflate a currency if you don't have to reference it against something like gold.
Isn't that a spiral?
It has become. But see, Nixon's single sin, I mean, you know, sort of like Woodrow Wilson's single sin was putting into place the Fed, and Nixon's single sin, because the greenback actually worked for I think 80 years or thereabouts, and you know, with the money supply of the United States actually being stable, but Wilson's failure was the Fed, Nixon's failure was taking us off the gold standard, but in my opinion, what happened during the Reagan administration was a radical transformation in economic policy in this country, moving away from classic economics.
What's the answer you think going?
Well, the answer I think is to return to not necessarily Keynesian economics. I think too much emphasis is put on John Maynard Keynes. Return to classic demand side economics. Say what we need to do is, if you want to increase the economy, is increase demand. And you increase demand by giving people more money so that they can spend that money. You do that by having strong labor unions so that people get decent wages, strengthening the middle class, and by having a tax on very, very, very high incomes that reflects their load on the commons of the currency, on the commons of the court system, on the commons of the entire system, as it were. And when we had this from 1940 to 1980, we had a strong middle class. And yeah, the years just leading up to 1980, we did see some significant inflation. But I am. Nothing is going to change my mind that, or at least I've seen nothing so far that would change my mind that was the consequence of Nixon and LBJ trying to have it both ways. They're trying to have a war, trying to have the Great Society, and trying to do it in large part on the basis of debt, and stagflation came along as a result of it. Rich in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Rich.
Hi, Tom. Let me see if I can get my head around what he was saying. The Reagan administration borrowed and borrowed and borrowed in order to have an arms race with the Soviet Union, to drive the Soviet Union into bankruptcy, so it collapsed, thereby creating a glut in socialist nations of manpower to take our jobs.
Well, the first half of what you said, Paul Craig Roberts never said, but in effect, that's exactly what happened.
Yeah. So,
and I would say that that glut of labor has always existed. There have, I mean, you know, there have always been hundreds of millions, if not billions, of people in the world who would do the jobs that people in America do in our factories. That if you built a factory in South America or in Africa or in Central America or Asia or whatever, I mean, you're always going to find people who will work cheaper than us. And the way that we protected ourselves from that happening, from the offshoring of jobs in the past, was we had, number one, tax disincentives for offshoring. We made it more difficult for that to happen. And number two, we had tariffs. We said, if you're going to make something outside the United States and bring it into the United States, we're going to tax it to the point where it's going to cost the same as if it was made with U.S. labor, thereby protecting U.S. labor. And those tariffs first went into place in 1787 in the United States. They were lobbied for by a small businessman by the name of Tench Cox. There's only been one book ever written about him, and it's pretty insightful. And, you know, America's first lobbyist, I guess. And those tariffs were 100% of the source of revenue that paid for the federal government, that paid the salaries of the president and the senators and ran the entire federal government, 100% of it up until the Civil War. Two-thirds of it up until World War I, and fully one-third of the federal government from World War I to World War II, during which time the federal government more than tripled in size. So they were always huge, very, very significant. And it was during the Reagan administration and then subsequently the Bush senior administration that so much that this loud argument was made that we need to do away with tariffs and replace them with this with international trade agreements and, you know, bilateral agreements, and then ultimately a national system, the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trades and the World Trade Organization, and in the North American sphere, the NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, and somehow that would throw it into the free market, and the free market will solve all problems. Well, it threw it into the free market, and basically the big corporate predators came in and said, hey, this is fun. You know, we can play in this water. We've got the money. And this is why right now, you talk about international trade, 40% of all international trade is within individual companies. In other words, it's Sony in China selling to Sony in the United States. It's General Motors in China making engines, selling them to General Motors in the United States. That's not international trade in the Adam Smith sense, in the classic sense of trade. That's not really trade. What that is simply arbitraging labor. It's moving labor around, moving money around. And anyhow, Rich, I got to take a break. I appreciate the call and it's interesting. I just find this stuff fascinating, how ultimately it all comes home to roost. And if Americans don't understand it, well, if we don't all hang together on this, we're going to hang separately on it. Let's put it that way. 45 minutes past.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active. This is Air America Radio.
Price for truth, and money doesn't bleed red, white, and blue. Oh, no, 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 and it never won't. Oh, say, can you see? Everybody's buying, but nobody's free. I won't be bought, freedom's all I own, and I know it's out there. And now I'm gonna find it before it's gone.
Yeah, that's as I was paraphrasing Ben Franklin as we went into the break there. We really do have to hang together on this whole variety of issues. Otherwise, we most certainly shall hang separately. Pete in Greeley, Colorado, listening on KKZN. Hey, Pete, what's up?
Hey, Tom. It seems like on the one end of the negative on Keynesianism, you know, we've got stagflation, and then the worst thing it seems to be on the monetarist end is like crippling indebtedness. My question is, it seems to me we use a combination of these two economic philosophies today. What's the balance between these two, and are they mutually exclusive, or are they compatible in some way?
Yeah, I'm not sure that we're, you know, accurately characterizing either one to put them on that spectrum. I mean, my understanding of John Maynard Keynes's main contribution to this thinking was that if you want to stimulate an economy, you have to stimulate demand. And the way that you stimulate demand is by giving people the means to buy things. And,
right. He characterizes that by putting money in a bottle and burying it if you have to. Just pay
that's
people
right.
to dig it up.
That's right. And if there is no other employer out there, then the employer of last resort is the government. And so in the Keynesian world, what you know, using Keynes's advice, what Franklin Roosevelt did is he created the Civilian Conservation Corps and the Works Progress Administration and all these basically government projects that built bridges and roads and dams and schools and sowed forests and all kinds of things as make work in order to put money into people's hands to generate demand so that people would buy things. And it slowly brought us out of the Great Depression. Now, one of the things that is overlooked, I think, in perhaps the history of that is the history of liquidity, of how much money is sloshing around and how available it is. Because the fact of the matter is that there was in 1929 and in 32, there were two significant contractions in our liquidity where the Federal Reserve actually reduced the amount of money in our, you know, in our money supply, in part because of the relationship because we were forcing Europe basically to pay back World War I debts. And by forcing Europe to pay back those World War I debts, we were trying to keep the dollar strong, reduce liquidity, increase, you know, and make sure that the money's good. And the bottom line was that liquidity crisis, some economists suggest, was really what was causing the Great Depression. And so what Roosevelt was doing using Keynesian economics was he dug us out of the hole, but the cause of the hole wasn't the cause that he was addressing. But he had no control over the Fed because the Fed's a private corporation, and all the president can do is appoint the Fed chief. He can't say to the Fed, you will create liquidity, although we've had Fed chairmen more recently who have been more willing to play, you know, suck up nice with politicians. Apparently we didn't in 29 and 32. And that would have been, by the way, not for Roosevelt to worry about. That was Herbert Hoover's problem. So those are competing theories. And then you get to the monetarist theory, the one dimension of it, you know, Milton Friedman's theories, which have been ascendant since 1981 in large part. One dimension of it is that ultimately it's impossible for the government to, at the macro level, at the large level, or at the micro level, at the small level, to manage the economy or to even help or have any positive effect on the economy, because there's 100 billion variables happening every instant. And so the only way that the economy will work itself out is if you just let all of those things happen. Well, that's actually technically impossible. You have to have rules. You have to have defined boundaries and things. But that logic of Friedman, Milton, and Thomas, by the way, the world is flat stuff, has brought us the end of tariffs and these trade, basically the rise of corporatism around the world and the destruction of the middle class, in my opinion.
Can we characterize it then? Thomas Keynesian still represents our macroeconomic measurements and criteria, and then monetarism is responsible basically for microeconomics. Can't we look at it that way?
I don't think so. I think we're getting a little too wonky here in the use of language, but I'd say broadly speaking, we need to recognize that demand is what drives economies, not supply. And just because something's available doesn't mean people are going to go right out and buy it. And what happened when supply side economics didn't work was they went back to demand-side economics, but they did it in a sneaky fashion. Instead of the government actually giving money to people in exchange for work, like with the WPA and the CCC, or the GI Bill for that matter, which was another variation on that, what they did was they jacked up the availability of credit, and they said to everybody, you can borrow, they flooded liquidity, and used the Fed to do it to a large extent, and said, you can borrow like crazy and go in debt. And this is something that my father's generation and your father and grandfather or mother and grandmother's generation just didn't do. And so basically it was demand-side economics again. In other words, it stimulated the economy, but it did it because people were willing or able to go into debt because that was being provided to them. So anyway, and it is ruining the economy. It's going to come back and bite us. It is biting us. Jake in San Francisco, we got about a minute here before we got to wrap up this hour. What's up?
Well, very briefly, about your guest who was talking about the effects of inflation, I think one of the things that we often don't hear about is that there's a big picture here, and that these events, inflation-wise and in terms of the national security state, economics and security, these are not isolated events. they're a part of a pattern, and they're part of processes, and processes have motives, and these things can be done not because of bad judgment, but the opposite.
This is the revolt of the elites. I mean, and what happened in 1980 was the power of inherited wealth and the power of corporate money had been eroded over the previous 40 years, and they said, enough of this already, we're going to take that power back, and ultimately that means economic power.
Yes, that's correct. And I think that, therefore, you know, when a child walks behind his mother, stares only at her heels, he never gets to see the big picture. And when we are diverted by all the things we're diverted by and don't look at that, we don't see what's really going on here as a process and a pattern and a set of motives.
Yep. Well said, Jake. Very well said. Thank you very much. Appreciate the call. Coming up next, David Sirota is going to be with us, political journalist and best-selling author of Hostile Takeover, How Big Money and Corruption Conquered Our Government and How We Can Take It Back. Speaking of the topic, 57 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program, transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. This is Air America Radio. Hartman Program, Viagra for your brain. This is Air America Radio.
Welcome back. 6 minutes past the hour. We approached a turning point, at least in theory, in 1992 when Bill Clinton was elected, or was campaigning, shall we say. We had the era of the New Deal, starting in the mid-1930s, going up until 1981 with the election of Ronald Reagan. And then we began this era of corporatism or monetarism or Friedmanism. You take your choice, Milton or Thomas, flat earthism, hostility to labor, doing away with, et cetera, et cetera. And the end of the New Deal, essentially, starting in 81. And in 92, this is what Bill Clinton campaigned against. Was he was going to undo Reaganomics. And we almost got there. But then Alan Greenspan and, as I recall, Robert Rubin sat, let me ask David Sirota. He, I'm sure, has the details to this. DavidSirota.com, his website. David, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, always glad to have you with us. Your most recent column, Over the Dead Bodies, again, conjures up images. You start of 1992. Give us the story.
Yeah, well, back in 1992, Bill Clinton, when he ran for president, ran on a fairly populist platform, and one of the things he said was that he wouldn't sign a trade deal with Mexico, NAFTA, unless it included strong labor, human rights, and environmental standards. He said that on the campaign trail at events of blue-collar workers, and then, of course, in 1993, he proceeded to, as president, he proceeded to ram NAFTA through Congress, quote, over the dead bodies of his main constituents, as American Express's CEO said at the time. Well, this kind of thing, what ended up happening was that drove down turnout among union households and progressive households in the 1994 election, which then led to the Republicans basically winning the Congress. You'd think the Democrats would have learned their lesson, but now we are at the precipice now in 2007 with, just months into the new Democratic Congress after many of the people who were elected ran against NAFTA, promising to reform our sort of sellout trade policy. They are now moving forward with a package of trade deals that would expand NAFTA much farther than NAFTA was ever even originally proposed to go, into Peru, Colombia, Panama, and South Korea, all NAFTA-style trade deals with almost none of the reforms that they had run on promising to change when they ran for Congress in 2006.
Yeah, and these are Democrats. I mean, the Republicans love this stuff because it means cheap labor and it drives down prices and increases corporate profits and increases CEO salaries. And also it wipes out the middle class, which makes the people working harder and harder and harder, so they have less and less time to actually pay attention to politics. and arguably more malleable politically. But the Democrats, you would think, would, as you say, would have learned from this. There's, you know, the story, perhaps apocryphal, I don't believe so, of Greenspan and Rubin sitting Bill Clinton down 2 weeks before he was inaugurated and saying,
right.
Now we're going to tell you the facts, buddy. You ran on becoming FDR, but instead you're going to be Reagan Light.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And you know, what's interesting is that you would think that the Democrats would have at least learned the political lesson. I mean, if you are sort of go down to the most craven level where you assume that all politicians only care about, you know, getting reelected, which I actually don't believe of all politicians. But point being is you'd think they would have at least learned the political lesson of what happened after NAFTA. But they haven't. And I think that's because, you know, what we still see is a party that is having an internal struggle between its Wall Street wing, you know, as epitomized by Bob Rubin and sort of the New Democrats, and its populist wing. And, you know, I think it's really a tragedy, I think, on both the political level and just the moral and policy level. I mean, you know, how many jobs do we have to have outsourced for them to learn this lesson? How much do wages have to stagnate for them to learn the lesson? And that's the key one, because when you pass these trade deals and you force Americans to compete with workers who have no human rights, who have no basic minimum wage. You know, in Colombia, you know, if you try to form a union, you get killed. It is the most dangerous place to try to organize a union. There are more union organizers killed in Colombia each year than in all the rest of the world's countries combined. So, you know, if you force Americans to compete with people like that, they are forced into a wage-cutting competition. A wage-cutting race to the bottom. And, you know, it's just unfathomable that the Democrats, after running on a populist platform, the very first thing they seem ready to be able to ram through Congress is a package of new NAFTAs.
Yeah. And I was astounded this morning looking at the headlines, USA Today, General Motors is on strike right now, or the workers of General Motors are on strike. And my understanding is that the reason that they went on strike is they want an assurance from the company that it's not going to outsource any more jobs, basically. That is, the new cars that it's going to be making, the Volt, and there's another, the small car, are going to be actually manufactured here in the United States. And that's the non-negotiable thing. There are a bunch of negotiations, you know, the union's saying they're willing to negotiate pensions. In fact, they may even be willing to take over the pension, you know, administer the pensions. They're willing to negotiate health care. They're willing to even negotiate wages, but they're not willing to negotiate any more outsourcing. And at that point, GM said, sorry, that's something that is not on the table to discuss. And this led to the walkout of the union. First of all, is my understanding of that correct?
I've heard that. I haven't followed it entirely, only because I'm on book deadline, but I have definitely heard that.
Well, I'm pretty sure that I'm right on that. And reading the story, the news story seemed to say that. But the headline, basically, and I should have brought it in with me. It's out in our cubicle. But the headline basically said, you know, that GM workers are going on strike and they're negotiating about pensions and health care. And that's my understanding is that that's really not the bottom line issue. The bottom line issue is no more outsourcing of our jobs. And this is, you know, is I guess the larger question here is, we're talking with David Sirota, by the way, davidsirota.com. Is the U.S. on a path to economic Armageddon? Are we going to reverse Friedmanism, Milton and Thomas? Are we, or corporatism, or whatever you want to call it, this bizarre path we've been on since 1981, are we going to reverse it, or are we going to keep going down this road? Alan Greenspan was running all over the media yesterday and trashing what he referred to as populism.
Right,
and, right. In fact, here, Luis just handed me the USA Today. Here's the headline at the top. Impasse at GM, UAW walks out. Job security, retiree health care are key issues for 73,000 workers in USA. Well, that's true. They are key issues, but that's not what they walked out over. And,
well, I mean, it is. I mean, I guess it is technically it is job security, right? If you don't want your job outsourced, and I think as it relates to these trade policies, you know, as you can see, the interplay between union negotiations and trade policy. If we had a trade policy that was different, that said to GM, that said to all the corporations in this country, that hey, you can't use our trade policy just to troll the world for the cheapest labor, the worst environmental conditions, and the worst human rights conditions.
And the highest profits.
And right, exactly. And so if you had a trade policy that said that, unions would be in a much better bargaining position to say, we're going to negotiate for all the other stuff, wages, benefits, pensions, job security, et cetera. The other way around is you've got a trade policy that says, yes, GM, you are encouraged to go out and try to find the cheapest labor, the worst environmental conditions, the worst human rights conditions, to lower your costs, raise your profits. And GM, of course, is not willing to negotiate on the issue of outsourcing because they have a trade policy that's sitting right there in front of them that's begging to be exploited.
Right. And you're talking about how this is, we're seeing a replay of 94 all over again, and that is that the Democrats lose ground to the Republicans because they're not holding to their core principles. They're not holding to their true principles. And you've got, you know, like Max Baucus going along with the Republicans, a whole bunch of Democrats going along with the Republicans on these kinds of things. And frankly, I'm seeing, you know, maybe I'm wrong on this, but correct me if I'm wrong. It seems like the only Democratic candidate for president of the major contenders who's really solid on this stuff has been John Edwards, or am I wrong?
That's absolutely right. I mean, you know, when I interviewed Barack Obama, for instance, he was very sort of wishy-washy on these trade issues, on these populist issues. You know, Hillary Clinton, she's cast some good votes, but, I mean, you know, she was there during NAFTA, during China PNTR, et cetera, et cetera. You know, I think you're absolutely right, and back to the political argument, that when the parties don't differentiate, the Democrats lose, and the Democrats really are going along with Wall Street on this.
Yeah, absolutely. It's Harry Truman's old joke about how if people are given the choice between a Republican or a Democrat who behaves like a Republican, they'll choose the Republican every time.
Exactly.
David Sirota, davidsirota.com, the website for his writings, his new book, or his most recent book, Hostile Takeover, How Big Money and Corruption Conquered Our Government. Thanks, David.
Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. 16 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to Tom Hartman, defending America from the weapons of mass deception on Air America Radio.
Welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number, tomhartman.com, airamerica.com for our blogs, our live chat room, and our message board. Howard in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Hey, Howard, you're one of the GM strikers?
Yes, I am.
Tell me.
I work at the Willow Run plant off Ypsilanti. It was on the program War last night. We were the bomber factory during the Second World War. That we just rolled out the bombers on an assembly line, which helped win the war.
That's amazing. It's a factory with an extraordinary history to it. And what, you know, from your point of view, what is this strike all about?
Well, you know, you talked about some of the issues earlier, but I really think it really comes down. Well, there's really no simple thing. I think one of the big issue, I believe, is the whole healthcare issue. Like, well, if you look at Toyota, they pay approximately $400 per car on health care costs. Now, while General Motors pays approximately $1,500 per car on health care costs. Now, the reason for that is we want a society where today is my birthday. I'm 54 years old, and I have 29 years seniority at my plant, and I'm low seniority. So you have to figure out that I am not one of the older workers. I'm actually probably one of the younger workers there. So you
right.
have a situation at my plant where, you know, in the past when you turned 50 like I was or I am, you lost your job. Now, we don't want that kind of society. So General Motors is at a disadvantage because they have
because they've been
like,
around longer, basically.
Yeah, yeah. And when you're older like I am, your health care costs go up. General Motors has 200,000 retirees. Toyota has 400. And you add up these things, and if you look at I read in the paper a couple weeks ago that the difference in labor costs between us and the transplants was approximately $1,500. Well, if you deduct the $400 from the $1,500, the healthcare costs make up $1,100 of the cost differential and labor costs. Now, the only way we can solve this problem is by going to national health insurance. And I don't understand why we haven't done it, why it's killing people like
we haven't done it because we have a multi-billion dollar industry that literally pays its CEOs, in the case of William McGuire at United Healthcare, over $1 billion, probably a multi-hundred billion dollar health insurance industry that has its hooks into virtually every politician in Washington, D.C.
Well, all I can say is it's killing me. I mean, my job is on the line, and I don't think this strike would be happening right now if we had resolved the health care issue. And it's destroying our economy. And you just look at the problems that people have. My family, most of the members of my family are not blessed to be in a union like I am. And up till now, I am the only member of my family that has not had trouble with their health insurance. My brother, who's a geologist, he paid in for health insurance. I mean, paid in for his private plan for years. He broke his leg a few years ago, and then suddenly they found a reason to cancel his policy.
Right.
I mean, it's insane. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I'm getting a little bit emotional.
No, you're absolutely right. I mean, the healthcare is probably going to be the defining issue in this presidential campaign.
I hope so.
Yeah, it is probably going to be the largest issue over the next 2 or 3 years here in the United States. But frankly, in my opinion, if we don't combine it with a rational trade policy so that we stop offshoring jobs, so that we start increasing the wealth of America and America's workers, and you know, I mean, because we're selling off our country right now in exchange to buy cheap stuff from overseas so that we can have other people do our manufacturing. If we don't bring back manufacturing in the United States, we got nothing. And you know, healthcare is just a symptom of a larger problem, and that is the disproportionate amount of power being held by a small number of corporate interests and you know, people like the Walton family representing inherited wealth who are making sure that their interests are taken care of nationally and multinationally, internationally, whereas the American workers' interests are not being taken care of. And finally, you guys at GM said enough. You know, we're going to go out on strike, and I wish you well on it.
Well, thank you. We're all, of course, scared. I mean, right now, we're basically the last of the working middle class. I mean, you look at how the unions have been destroyed. When I started working at General Motors, about 29% of the private sector was unionized. Today it's 8%. We had 1,500,000 people in the UAW. We now have 500,000. And as, you know, the labor movement in this country has been crushed, what has happened? Fewer people have pensions, fewer people have health insurance. The middle class has been devastated. It's affected everybody. Toyota?
I'm sorry, Howard. We're out of time, but your point is really well made. Happy birthday, by the way.
Oh, thank you.
And good luck with the strike, and thanks a lot for calling in and informing us. But your point is absolutely perfectly and brilliantly made, and thank you very much for it. India, exporting jobs, outsourcing. I'll tell you about that right after this, and we'll continue to take your calls at 866-303-2270. 27 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
Four minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Strange stuff going on out there, I'll tell you. Yes, a couple's bid to spice up their love life backfired. Poor poor Zoe Comish, a resident of the United Kingdom, handcuffed to a bed for 2 hours after her boyfriend, Stuart Fisher, lost the key. So they called the fire department. And when the fire department learned that there was a naked woman handcuffed to a bed and needed a key or a pair of bolt cutters, for some reason, it took 20 firemen, 3 policemen, and 2 hours to get her free. Stuart says, we're just trying to spice up our sex life, but including 3 policemen and 20 firemen wasn't in the plan. And then it gets even stranger. Brothel owners in Bulgaria are blaming global warming for staff shortages. They claim that their best girls are now working in ski resorts because lack of snow has forced tourists to seek other pleasures instead of they can't ski anymore. So all the ladies are going to the ski resorts. Strange stuff. And last but not least, lest I forget, as I mentioned before the break, this actually from the New York Times, straight story. Outsourcing works so well, India is exporting jobs. Thousands of Indians report to Infosys Technologies campus here in Mysore, India, to learn the finer points of programming. And now they're outsourcing those jobs to Brazil, Chile, Uruguay, Shanghai, Portugal, Romania, and Saudi Arabia. Wipro, Cognizant, Tata, all these are Indian companies that are no longer hiring Indians. I guess Indians are getting too expensive. They're now going, well, pretty soon it'll be Bulgarians. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. And Tom in Cincinnati, Ohio. Hey, Tom, welcome to the program.
Oh, thanks for taking my call, Tom. Concerning your last caller from General Motors.
Yeah.
I'm kind of questioning his issue on health care. And I bet you he's making like $25, $30 an hour.
Yeah, and shouldn't every worker in America earn
enough? Well, I wish, but I work.
Yeah, well, that's the point. There was a time in the United States when more than half of our labor force did. And the only way we're going to get back to that is if labor stands up and says enough already. And it's the tragedy is that striking against General Motors isn't going to change our trade policies.
Well, that's true. But I work for a large company also, and I make about $32,000 a year. I'm single. I'm very comfortable with the way I'm living. And I'm wondering, you know, with their wages, and he's complaining about health costs, is he willing to take away some of his wages to help the company out with the health costs?
Yeah, and see, it's the wrong question to be asking, Tom. Because that question, that's the question that the conservatives always want us to be arguing
about.
How far down are we willing to go?
I'm a Democrat. I'm not a conservative.
No, I understand that. I'm not accusing you of anything. What I'm saying is that the discussion shouldn't be about how much are we willing to reduce our standard of living, how much are we willing to reduce our pay. It should be instead, how do we change the rules of the game back to the way they were in ways that protect the middle class, the build and strengthen the middle class, and small D democracy, at the same time, helping build, reduce poverty around the world. Frankly, I would suggest that neoliberalism is increasing poverty around the world, not reducing it, as Greenspan says. And so I think that, you know, asking the question of, well, you know, is this guy willing to take a pay cut to help his company is the wrong question. We should ask, is the company willing to lobby so that they...
I already know the answer to that. There's no...
Well, is the company willing to lobby in order for legislation that will change the trade rules so that they don't feel that they have to say to this guy, you know, you're gonna work for $10 an hour because if you don't, we're gonna move to Mexico. Like, I mean, you know, go back to Michael Moore's first movie, Roger and Me. It was all about GM shutting down 5 factories in Flint, moving them to Mexico. Mm-hmm. And so I think we're asking the wrong question. And then, like I said, the tragedy of it is, I mean, the good news is that the workers at GM are standing up. The tragedy is they're taking a huge risk, and that whatever comes out of it with General Motors is not probably going to change our trade policy unless it spurs the kind of conversation that you and I are having right now in larger venues. I mean, you know, in among the mainstream media and in the national news. And, yeah. And hopefully it will. And hopefully Ron Gettelfinger will get out there and will use this as an opportunity to talk about these larger issues. But I'm not seeing it happening immediately, and it concerns me. Tom, thank you for the call. I appreciate it. Mike in Queens, New York. Hey, Mike, what's up?
Hey, Tom, great show. I got two quick things. For one, my personal opinion, the problems that Jimmy Carter had with inflation, that was because of the after effects of the dollar going off the gold market.
Oh, that's interesting. In 71 or 72, Nixon took us off the gold standard, and you think that that's why in 77 and 78 the dollar was...
It takes a little time, you know?
That makes perfect sense, Mike.
But one more quick thing. I know we would need a Teddy Roosevelt or Franklin Delano Roosevelt to do this, and we would need to get out of debt pretty much, but what would it take for us to go back on the gold standard?
Well, we may end up having to. I mean, if our currency becomes the... and this would have been an interesting thing to discuss with Paul Craig Roberts back a couple hours ago. If our currency becomes the pariah of the world rather than the standard of the world, mm-hmm. how do you rebuild your currency?
Mm-hmm.
You know, if the full faith and credit of the United States is no longer, if the world no longer has faith in it and the credit doesn't hold up, you know, going back to a precious metal standard may be a way to do it. I don't think it's going to happen, but it may be a way to do it. Good point. Thank you very much, Mike. I appreciate it. June in Portland, Oregon, listening on KPOJ. Hey, June.
Oh, good morning. I was Canadian-born. I am Canadian-born, but I immigrated a long, long time ago. Anyway, I still have a bunch of relatives in Canada. A cousin of mine was in an auto accident. This was some years ago. A broken arm. And for some reason, the arm would be set, and it would not knit. And the doctors would have to break it and reset it. And this went on, I don't know, 3-4 times, and she was about ready to say, take it off, you know, I can't endure this any longer. And the doctors said, no, we'll try one more time. So the final time, it did knit. It was a successful healing, and then she kept her arm. But this took a long time. It would have taken many, many, many thousands of dollars, but it was all paid for. So pass that along.
Yeah. So you want, in other words, the bottom line lesson of the story, June, assuming that the failure of healing was not the result of incompetent doctors, but it was rather
it was her own
genetic quirkiness or something,
possibly diet or whatever. Yeah.
Yeah. Whatever it was.
Yeah,
that
right.
The Canadian healthcare, in your opinion, is a good thing. Yeah. Yeah. Thank you very much, Craig in Charlottesville, Virginia. Hey, Craig, listening to WVAX.
Hey. I've been on Social Security disability since the year 2000.
Yeah.
And this year I turned 60, and under SSDI I became eligible for Medicare. So I went and applied for Medicare, got my card, and they said, well, you know, you don't give this card to your doctor when you go to the doctor. You have to apply with this company called Humana, and they'll give you a card which you use at your doctor. And my jaw dropped, and I said, what? And basically it seems like they operate like any other HMO. How did Social Medicare become privatized? How did they get their hooks into the Medicare system?
I don't know the genesis of it. I don't know the details of exactly when it began or how it happened, but it's been going on for the better part of 15 years or so, and at least. I agree with you about the jaw-dropping part. It's like single-payer health care should be single-payer health care, and it's crazy to have for-profit corporations in the middle of it. It's absolutely crazy.
Before I signed up, I had never heard of this.
Yeah, well,
talk about it either.
Welcome to age 60, I guess.
Yeah.
I still have some years to go, but I have a feeling, you know, a lot of us are going to have some surprises. And this is, again, why we have to have this conversation in this country. Craig, thanks a lot for the call. 1-866-303-2270. Howard in Coriopolis, Pennsylvania. Hey, Howard.
Okay. I want to give you my opinion and see what you think. And I think that the Democrats should be, we need to get the White House for one thing and retain Congress, and we need to get our hands on the tax code. The tax code that Reagan so proudly said, oh, look at this big book, we got to change all this stuff. Well, I say to you that we have to reward companies that retain their employees in America. And we have to put a penalty on companies who outsource to foreign countries. And
And right now we're doing the reverse, by the way, as a consequence of the tax.
And if that's in violation of the WTO and NAFTA and all that, well, I'm sorry, then we're going to have to just get out of those organizations.
Yeah. Well, well said, Joe. I absolutely agree with you, Howard. Thank you very much. Alex in Michigan. Hey, Alex.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I'm great, but I'll get better. What's up?
Well, I just wanted to talk about, I'm an auto worker, and I want to talk about health care a little bit because the auto workers have been paying higher and higher health care costs. I mean, they've been putting us into HMOs. The prescription drug prices have been going up. And I think the strike is important. I mean, we've got to draw a line in the sand. And my suggestion would be is I think what this country needs is a general strike. I mean, one day we should all just say no to the war in Iraq, no to no single health care plan, and take it from there.
Yeah, and just take to the streets like they do, and like they have historically in France, for example, or in many other European countries. Alex, interesting point. The problem that we have right now is that the corporatists have such a stranglehold on us. There's so little social safety net. There's so little fallback. There's so much fear, frankly, economic fear, that I don't think a general strike is going to happen in America.
Listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone, on Air America Radio. Call Tom at
By the way, I'll be speaking at the Green Festival on October 6th, 6 p.m. on the main stage in Washington, D.C., the Washington Green Festival at the Washington, D.C. Convention Center, if you happen to be in town on October 6th. Should be great fun. Drop by, say hi. Victoria Jones, speaking of Washington, D.C., the Talk Radio News Service based in Washington, is on the line with us with a report from Washington. What's going on? Hey, Helen. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom. Well, that's pronounced Vic.
Sorry. It's been a long day.
And, I'm pronouncing it that way because, as you may have heard, that the president has phonetic spellings for some names and countries that have popped up.
Oh, really?
Yes.
For example?
Well, some of them it's understandable, and this has come out and they're not happy about this. Kyrgyzstan.
Mm.
That's understandable. Mauritania,
right.
But here's one that it is a little surprising that it was written down for him, because you would expect him to know Sarkozy.
Yeah, okay.
This one was written down for him so that he wouldn't get it wrong, and Caracas, and
amazing.
Mugabe.
So he doesn't know any of this stuff just from reading the news or paying attention to what's going on in the world. He has to be given phonetic spellings like a kid reading a teleprompter or something.
No, apparently not. Apparently a marked-up speech, a draft of the president's speech popped up on the UN's website this morning that included phonetic spellings of some names and countries. And Dana Perino got quite annoyed when a reporter asked if the president has trouble pronouncing some countries' names, and she called it an offensive question, something I've been told myself by her, as a matter of fact. And she said that it was taken down and there's nothing more to say about it, which is her way of saying that she's really got nothing to say about it.
Oh, my. And that's that, right?
That's
so
that.
So there's big protests in Washington or in New York City today. World Can't Wait, Drive Out the Bush Regime. They're scattered around town doing and at the UN doing protests. There yesterday, large protests at the UN against Mahmoud Ahmadinejad speaking there, and some, I suppose, in favor of him speaking. I'm not sure. I wrote an op-ed saying I thought it was, Columbia University was treating its It's students like adults. Gee, what a novel idea. Letting us make up our own minds about what this guy has to say.
Wow, and, yeah, that's a thought.
Yeah, well, it does, it's not something that seems to go well with conservatives. They seem to think that they should be telling us who we can listen to and who we can't.
Well, they don't think women should be able to make decisions about their own bodies either. So, you know, that would go along with that.
Well, and I suspect some of them don't think women should even be able to vote.
That's a thought, yeah.
But, in fact, it would be interesting to look at the Republican caging lists, you know, that Tim Griffin, for example, Karl Rove's protege, the caging that he was doing where they send out, you know, mail to people to try to demonstrate that they're not there so they can challenge them when they vote so they can get them knocked off the voting rolls to see if there's a gender difference. We know that there's a race difference, but
and
we know that there's... Yeah, that there's a difference that has to do with income, but I've not heard about there being a gen. It would be interesting to find out. What else is going on in Washington, D.C. today?
Well, that really is the main thing, obviously, the president's speech. The other thing that is going on is the Kyle Lieberman amendment that you talked about yesterday. That is to be voted on, and that is something that now Senator Jim Webb is getting really quite impassioned about. He's made a very strong appeal to his fellow senators, saying that it should be withdrawn. He says it's Dick Cheney's fondest pipe dream. Real concern, basically saying that if this thing goes down, that we're effectively saying that we could go to war with Iran.
Yeah,
and
it is a virtual form of the authorization that Bush got for Iraq.
When you look at the language, I haven't looked at the language, and I have done now. It's at least the relevant language, and it's pretty strong stuff. Now, it's only a sense of the Senate, but nevertheless, it's something that is taken quite seriously overseas.
Yeah, yeah, and frankly, I think will be taken quite seriously by the Bush administration. I mean, that's the whole point, and that's the whole, you know, why they want it. And, yeah, this is – any sense of how the vote is going to go on this thing?
Well, Kyle says he thinks it's going to pass, quote, rather handily. At the moment, it looks as though it probably will pass quite well, mostly because it seems to be like a shadow thing, that people just aren't aware of it, don't realize it's there or don't realize what it says, haven't become aware of the import of it.
Yeah.
It's just going to happen.
Not a good thing.
Not
a good thing at all.
No.
Amazing. Well, Victoria, and hopefully our listeners will call their senators and 202-225-3121 and say, you know, do not vote for that amendment, for Senator Kyle's amendment that will essentially authorize the president to attack Iran if he decides that he can come up with some sort of rationale for it. I mean, because that's basically the bottom line of the language.
And they might want to do that fairly soon, because if they're interested, because that is something that's coming up for a vote fairly soon.
Like in the next few minutes or
well,
the next few hours.
Well, I don't know exactly when, but today is what we're hearing.
Okay, 202-225-3121. What's the actual name of the amendment? Do you have that in front of you?
I just know that it's a sent of the Senate resolution. I don't know the exact name
of it.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, the Kyle resolution, I think most people would say, or the Iran resolution would probably do it just fine.
Yeah.
Okay, Victoria Jones, Washington, D.C., talkradionews.com. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
Always good talking with you. Coming up tomorrow, Steve Laffey is going to be here from the Club for Growth about his new book, Primary Mistakes, How the Washington Republican Establishment Lost Everything in 2006. And Everything is, you know, is Wrong, I'll be moderating a debate between Matt Prescott from PETA and Eric Barron. Can you be an environmentalist and still be a meat eater? That and your calls right here on the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People. And remember, my friends, democracy begins with you, activism begins with you. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow. Stick around.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. For exclusive Tom Hartman archives and more information, visit us online at airamericaradio.com.